12th annual summit of BRICS kicks off in South Africa, with member states calling for the use of local currencies to facilitate trade. Iran says it's already taken the extra mile in combating money laundering, stressing that the Financial Action Task Force should not be used as a political tool. Also in the headlines, over 1,000 people are still unaccounted for 2 weeks after the deadliest wildfires in recent U.S. history hit Hawaii. Thanks for joining us. The 15th annual summit of BRICS, a bloc of five major emerging economies, has kicked off in the South African city of Johannesburg. In their remarks, the leaders of BRICS member states called for the use of local currencies to facilitate trade and investment. They also criticized existing global payment systems, saying that they are manipulated for political purposes. The bloc's leaders urged fundamental reforms and greater cooperation to advance prosperity for all. They also called for the expansion of BRICS. The Chinese and Brazilian presidents, the Indian Prime Minister, the Russian Foreign Minister, as well as leaders and representatives from some 50 other countries are in attendance. Addressing the summit virtually, the Russian President Vladimir Putin said the group's influence is strengthening.
BRICS stands for a multipolar world order that is equitable and built on international law and the principles of the United Nations Charter, including respect for the right of every people to its own development path. Some countries promote their hegemony, exceptionality, and their policy of the ongoing colonialism and neocolonialism. I would like to note that the aspiration to preserve their hegemony in the world led to a dire crisis in Ukraine.
Meanwhile, the Chinese president called for deeper cooperation to advance economic growth. He also urged political and security cooperation to promote peace. BRICS is expected to consider granting new memberships during its three-day summit, as over 40 countries have expressed interest in joining it. They include Iran, that applied for the membership last year. The Iranian president, Ebrahim Raisi, has also been invited to Johannesburg to take part in the summit. BRICS is a consensus-based organization. Every five members must agree on the principle of expansion and criteria for new members. Pepe Escobar, a geopolitical analyst from Moscow, joined us earlier to share his views on the ongoing BRICS summit and its plan for a common currency.
The notion of swing states. These swing states are the states that they simply cannot allow to be to escape American influence. We have three BRICS, Brazil, India, and South Africa. And we have three, probably, BRICS plus, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. So at the current stage, the best BRICS can hope for is increased trade in their own currencies, the five currencies, plus the currencies of the BRICS plus members, and trying to devise payment settlement mechanisms that escape SWIFT, and they are a direct among the BRICS. For instance, Iran has its own payment system, alternative to SWIFT. Russia as well, the Chinese as well. So the first step would be to get these three together. And if you have Russia, China, and Iran in an organized payment system, alternative to SWIFT, there will be many other developing nations that will be on board. Practically immediate. So all these steps are even more necessary than simply say that we need BRICS common currency. This is not going to happen anytime soon. And this is part of the discussions that I have had here in Moscow with people from the financial market, very knowledgeable. And they basically explained to me in detail how difficult it is to set up a new currency. In the case of the euro, for instance, it took more than 10 years. In the case of a new currency, the BRICS currency, it could take more than 10 years or even two decades, until 2049, let's put it this way, to have a new currency. But this, the most important thing is that this trend has already started, and they are getting finally decisions at the highest level, at the head of state level, in terms of how we're going to proceed together geoeconomically, starting today with all of them sitting on the same table in Johannesburg.
Iran's Ministry of Economic Affairs and Finance has held the country's first conference on combating money laundering and financing terrorism in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 managers from different institutions have attended this seminar. The conference is set to provide a perfect platform for Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Money laundering. Simply put, it means one conceals the origin of the money obtained from illicit activities. The term money laundering is said to have its origins in the U.S. in the 1920s and 30s. Most gangsters, such as Al Capone, used laundries as a cover for the illegal money they made because the amount of cash flowing into laundry operations was challenging to track. This way, large sums of money could be processed without being noticed. Governments have been dealing with this issue for decades, working hard to put an end to it. In 2008, Iran established the Economy Ministry's Financial Intelligence Unit, or FIU, headed by the country's economy minister for this purpose. On Tuesday, the FIU held Iran's first national anti-money laundering and financing terrorism conference in the capital, Tehran. Over 300 senior managers from different institutions took part in this seminar to discuss strengthening and developing necessary infrastructure to prevent and deal with corruption, especially money laundering. Speaking on the sidelines of the conference, Iran's economy minister Ehsan Khanduzi said the Islamic Republic has higher standards in blocking the path of money laundering and financing terrorism compared to many countries in the world.
According to the financial and judicial reports, important measures have been taken in Iran in the field of fighting against money laundering and financing terrorism, which is unprecedented. We expect the FATF working group to adopt a technical approach in its evaluation instead of a political approach.
Khanduzi also pointed to Iran's membership at the Financial Action Task Force, saying Tehran's position in the FATF is active, not passive. Organizers of the conference say it has provided a perfect platform for the senior managers of Iranian organizations to achieve synergy in combating money laundering.
Keeping Iran's financial system healthy is one of the priorities of the administration of President Ebrahim Raisi. In this regard, Tehran has been taking serious steps to combat money laundering and deal with disruptors of the economy. Mahdi Abbasian, Tehran.
The head of the Financial Intelligence Unit of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Hadi Khani, says the Islamic Republic has gone an extra mile in combating money laundering. He made the remarks in an exclusive interview with Press TV on the sidelines of the first national anti-money laundering and funding terrorism conference in Tehran.
We believe that our laws and regulations, infrastructure, approaches, and determination of our government and institutions testify that the Islamic Republic has managed to fight money laundering and terrorist financing in a way that fully covers international standards. We have even acted beyond that. Despite Iran's internal challenges as well as regional situations, many measures the country has taken are more than what the FATF had demanded from other nations. We are focused on enforcing our own laws and regulations, organize our bylaws and instructions in proportional to our interests. We have maximum transparency in our financial system. Regarding the FATF, it has been said before that the Islamic Republic pursues an active approach. We acclaim our achievements. We have recently reported our activities to the Eurasian Group on combating money laundering and financing of terrorism. We believe that if the FATF acts based on a technical framework and not the political one, we have a lot to offer to the international community.
An Iranian national who has been illegally imprisoned in Sweden since the year 2019 has lamented his ordeal in the European country's jail. Hamid Nouri told his family in a phone call that he has been held in solitary confinement for nearly 4 years. Nouri said that prison authorities strip him naked every week for body search. He also complained that he has been rarely allowed to make contact with his family. Back in November 2019, Nouri was arrested upon arrival at Stockholm Airport. Swedish prosecutors accused him of being involved in the execution of members of Anti-Iran Mujahideen Khal, or MEK, terrorist organization. He has rejected the accusations as politically motivated. Chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajareh, joined us with his take on the ordeal Iranian national Hamid Nouri is going through in a Swedish jail.
We really need to sort of look at why at such a time they are prosecuting someone who they claim was involved in sort of abuse of due process in Iran in dealing with what is known a terrorist organization. And if you compare that with what the United States and the West is doing, using drones, which is extrajudicial killing, which results in killing not just those who they are judge, jury, and executioner, but innocent people. And not a single person on that process, which actually killed hundreds of thousands and millions of people in the last 10, 15, 20 years, have been ever prosecuted by anyone in the West, let alone Sweden. Why is it? Very clearly, they're abusing their own processes, their due processes, in prosecution to start with, because having spoken to the lawyers, they are saying that all their due processes have been undermined by the prosecutors. And now, even in prison, their processes have been undermined. He's being kept in the solitary confinement, which is unlawful in Sweden. And the way that he's been abused, weekly, sort of strip searching, etc., these are processes that is known internationally to be against international law, against human rights.
Palestinian fishermen in the besieged Gaza Strip put their lives in danger each time they go fishing to make a living amid threats posed by Israeli naval forces. Ola Alassi has more from the Gaza Strip.
Fishing is the second most important sector in the Gaza Strip's economy, but has become amongst the most dangerous jobs there. The fishing industry in Gaza is not viable anymore due to the Israeli naval blockade, which has stifled inflicting misery on the Palestinian fishermen. Fishermen are always forced to stay close to the shore in shallow waters, where they struggle for a catch.
The Israeli occupation has been systematically and deliberately destroying the fishing sector for the last 16 years. Israeli gunboats harass, shoot at, and abduct the Palestinian fishermen and destroy their equipment and confiscate their boats. Gaza's maritime borders are only 40 kilometers for fishing, but in fact, we have zero nautical miles. Israeli authorities prevent the entry of the fishing equipment, engines, and spare parts. All these tactics have affected the fishing industry and pushed it into crisis. Half of the Palestinian fishermen in Gaza are living below the poverty line.
Palestinian fishermen get strip searched and detained when they go more than 3 nautical miles from the shore and are subjected to deliberate murder by the Israeli naval forces. Mahmoud Becker is one of the Palestinian fishermen who was arrested up to 3 times, detained and injured many times by the rubber bullets fired by the Israeli forces. The last time he was injured was in 2018 when he lost his eye.
We can't sail peacefully in the sea. Israeli gunboats chase us and spray water, or open fire at us to destroy our equipment. When we go to the sea, we risk our lives to make a living. Sometimes we never make it back home. In 2018, I was shot with prohibited dum-dum bullets, which expanded in my head and led to loss of my eyesight. I was shot in my arm, abdomen, and head. Since then, I couldn't go fishing again with one eye. Nowadays, I maintain fishing nets. I barely support my family.
The fishing industry has become precarious. Fishermen in Gaza struggle with the increasing operating costs as the Israeli regime prevents Palestinians from having access to the fishing equipment and fiberglass needed to manufacturing the boats. They also suffer from the increasing fuel prices and scarcity of fish. Most of the fishermen can barely make ends meet.
This profession has passed through generations in my family. But now, seeing all the risks that a fisherman encounters at the Gaza Sea, I don't think I will pass and teach it to my children.
When we hear the shooting by the Israeli gunboats, we get scared and our families rush to the shore to check on the fishermen. My husband used to spend days at sea and sometimes came out without a sufficient amount of fish. We often spend months without eating fish. When my husband was arrested, it was tragic for our children. I became their mother and father. After he lost his eye, it has become impossible to meet my children's needs. Three of them suffer different illnesses.
Israel's policy against the fishing sector in the Gaza Strip is a form of collective punishment and amount to a war crime. Last week, Israeli naval forces arrested six fishermen, injured four, and confiscated two boats and destroyed a bigger one.
Living under the Israeli occupation means living in a constant state of suppression and persecution. The sea for Gazans is not only a source of enjoyment, but also a source of suffering. Al-Asif, Gaza.
Over 1,000 people are still missing, some 2 weeks after devastating wildfires ravaged parts of the U.S. state of Hawaii. Authorities have put the number of missing people at around 1,100. The FBI is seeking the help of family members in identifying the remains of the dead. They have been collecting DNA samples from those who were out of the fire-ravaged Maui County. 115 people have so far been confirmed dead in the wildfires that were described as the worst in U.S. history. Blazes forced harrowing escapes and displaced thousands. Officials have been criticized for failing to issue alerts and their lackluster response to the tragedy. Hawaii's Attorney General has already opened an investigation into the authorities' handling of the wildfires. More climate news. In Greece, raging wildfires near the Daudia Forest have claimed 15 lives as fire crew are battling the blazes for the fourth consecutive day. Authorities are said to be trying to identify the victims, since no locals have been reported missing. Officials speculate the bodies might belong to migrants who entered the country illegally. Strong winds continue to fan the flames that have also destroyed some factories. In the nearby port town of Alexandroupolis, dozens of hospital patients were evacuated on Tuesday. Southern Europe has been hit by a new heat wave, with temperatures at some places reaching or exceeding 40 degrees Celsius. Summer wildfires are common in Europe, but have been exacerbated in recent years that scientists blame on climate change. Russia has reported the downing of more Ukrainian drones attempting to target the capital, Moscow. The Defense Ministry says one drone was jammed and two others were shot down over the western part of the capital early on Wednesday. Just a day ago, authorities were forced to temporarily shut three airports in the capital after several drones were spotted and intercepted over the Moscow region. Russian officials have repeatedly cautioned that drones could cause a major disaster to Moscow with 22 million population. Ukraine has not commented on the latest drone strikes, but the two countries have increased cross-border attacks in recent weeks.
And that is for this edition of World News. That's bye-bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough. Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, on August 6, 2023, with a meeting with the commander's crew and families of the 86 flotilla of the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy. The 86th Flotilla's great accomplishment is an honor that has been carried out for the first time in the maritime history. If we put aside the humiliating years of the Pahlavi and Qajar rule, we did have seafaring before and it wasn't bad. But what we had before was far less than what you have accomplished today. Your flotilla brought about this great honor. A group of 350 people with an experienced, skillful commander was able to travel 65,000 kilometers circumnavigating the globe. You were at sea for almost 8 months, 232 days to be exact. These are great achievements. In the world's most renowned naval forces, there are few people who have accomplished this and are able to accomplish this. But you accomplish this. You sail across three oceans and return proudly to your homeland. What you accomplished is very meaningful. It cannot be viewed as being merely a naval or military event. What you did has depth.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
I would like to mention a few things about this. First of all, this great movement shows that there is great determination, willpower, and self-confidence in our military forces. These are very important matters. Three important factors: being determined, making an effort by having willpower, and having self-confidence. In other words, having a "we can" mindset. That's one side of the story. There is also the matter of military knowledge and the ability to design. An important component of these operations is their design. It is very important that an organization is able to design something like this, which is the military knowledge. And yet, another dimension includes courage, perseverance, and the ability to endure hardships. We speak easily about spending 8 months at sea. However, those who have spent just 2 or 3 days at sea understand what 8 months on the water means. Enduring these hardships is very important. You see, your work tells of these truths. Each of these truths deserves attention. That is, one very important thing is that, for example, a military group was able to acquire the capability to design an operation of this kind.
Allah, I want to thank you. I
Fires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Nearly 1 month into a military coup in Niger, the situation remains tense there as the country grapples with political uncertainty. As part of efforts to reverse last month's coup, a delegation from West Africa's main regional bloc, ECOWAS, has met with junta leader General Abdourahamane Tchiani in the capital, Niamey. The delegation, led by Nigeria's former military leader, Abdoulsalami Abubakar, and accompanied by ECOWAS Commission President Omar Touré, has also met with Nigeria's ousted president, Mohamed Bazoum. Although there has been no detail on the outcome of the talks, General Tchiani said in a televised address that neither coup leaders nor the Nigerian people want war and remain open to dialogue.
In short, neither the military junta nor the people of Niger want war and remain open to dialogue. But let us be clear, if an aggression is launched against us, it will not be the easy ride that some people think it is. They will be up against 26 million Nigerians.
Tchiani said the junta was pursuing its own agenda and would launch a national dialogue to consult on a transition back to democracy, which should last no longer than 3 years.
I am calling on all the living forces to engage in an inclusive national dialogue. The aim of the body dedicated to this dialogue is to consult all the components of the people of Niger on the best ways to lay the foundations of a new constitutional life on pillars deeply rooted in our traditional and republican values.
Tchiani's comments and meeting of ECOWAS representatives with coup leaders and former President Bazoum come as the bloc on Friday doubled down its threat to use force as a last resort to restore democracy in Niger. It said an undisclosed D-Day had been agreed for possible military intervention there. This was enough reason for thousands of Nigerians to hit the streets of Niamey to throw their backing behind coup leaders. The developments in Niger come as coups are normally rejected by nature, no matter the time and place they take place. But the public support for the military junta does indeed convey a message. The disillusionment and dissatisfaction with the previous regime can be named as such. A desire for change and a belief that the military might bring stability or address grievances that have not been adequately addressed by the previous government is among reasons behind the public support for Niger junta leaders. But in the case of the West's stance toward Niger developments, what comes to the spotlight is Western countries' push for a military intervention in Niger to reverse the coup. Are they really seeking for the establishment of a civilian rule, or are there real concerns that the persistence of a military rule would not meet the demands of people across the West African nation? Western countries claim that they are involved in a fight against terrorists linked to Al-Qaeda and Daesh. But taking a glimpse at West's interests in Niger proves that seeking a civilian rule in Niger for the sake of its people would be so naive. In the case of France, Paris is seeking to maintain its grip on valuable uranium reserves in Niger. After all, the French government is entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to Germany and other European countries. This makes France huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali. Maybe that's why, seeing its political interests in tatters, Washington is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate the pro-Western president. All what it is, the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians and they're the ones who should decide their own fate is of very high significance. Given all the anti-West hatred among the people of Niger and other nations across the Sahel region, it seems that it is for the West to stop meddling in the affairs of those countries and let the people decide their own political future. The situation remains volatile around Taiwan as Chinese military has carried out joint exercises there. In a statement, the Chinese Defense Ministry said it carried out joint naval and air combat readiness patrols around the island. It said it was holding the exercises and training of naval and air forces, focusing on ship-aircraft coordination and seizing control to test the forces' actual combat capabilities. The Chinese military said the equipment deployed included destroyers, frigates and missile boats, as well as fighters, early warning and jamming aircraft that assembled in a predetermined area. Taiwan's defense ministry said it detected 42 Chinese aircraft and 8 ships involved in the drills around the island as of Saturday morning, and it had deployed ships and aircraft in response. The Chinese military said the maneuvers were a serious warning against Taiwan independent separatist forces colluding with external forces to provoke. Taiwan's government strongly condemned the drills. The Taiwanese Defense Ministry said it had the ability, determination, and confidence to ensure national security of Taiwan. The government's Mainland Affairs Council, which makes Taiwan's China policy, urged Beijing to stop what it called the intimidation and start talks, saying Taiwan's people were determined to defend themselves and would never succumb to threats of force. The council added Taiwan is a sovereign country and has a legitimate and legal right to conduct normal diplomatic interactions with friendly countries. The drill comes against the backdrop of a visit by Taiwan's Vice President William Lai to the United States. Lai, who was a frontrunner to become Taiwan's president in elections in January, made a number of stopovers and gave speeches while on the visit. This stopover of Taiwan's vice president to the U.S. comes as previous instances of such diplomatic visits have been the source of tensions between Beijing and Taipei, and subsequently China and the United States. That includes a visit by former Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi. Beijing launched joint military exercises around the island and suspended or canceled 8 official military dialogues and cooperation channels with the United States. In April this year, Taiwan's President Tsai Ing-wen met House Speaker Kevin McCarthy on a stopover in California. Beijing authorities blasted off some angry statements, imposed sanctions against a handful of individuals or entities involved in Tsai's trip, and sent warships and planes past Taiwan. Not to mention that several U.S. delegations, comprising of American lawmakers, have traveled to the self-ruled island and met with Taiwanese officials, drawing angry reactions from Beijing. China argues that any official exchanges with Taiwan will boost calls for independence in the self-ruled island. But apart from those diplomatic exchanges, tensions over Taiwan have been escalating ever since the United States enhanced its military buildup in the South China Sea in an effort to contain Beijing. After all, China has territorial claims over the self-ruled island and has warned against any move that jeopardizes its sovereignty and territorial integrity. But regardless of those warnings, Washington has continued with its collision course with Beijing over the issue of Taiwan. The sailing of U.S. vessels through the Taiwan Strait is just to name one. That raises the question that how would the United States react if Chinese destroyers sailed through areas close to U.S. borders in the North Atlantic or the North Pacific Oceans, or anywhere near the Gulf of Mexico for that matter. Given all the tensions between Washington and Beijing, what seems to be further complicating the situation is numerous provocations on the part of the United States against China. From those diplomatic visits to sailing of warships to areas close to Taiwan, all seems to be preparing the ground for full-scale confrontation between the two countries.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
Looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid, things we have seen throughout those 4 months, may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and rapid support forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid support forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. In 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019.
Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. A coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
As you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean like different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube Port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the Poles, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus." Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Imam Ali alayhi salatu wasalam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
I would like to take this opportunity to talk about one dimension of the personality of Amir al-Mu'mineen.
As-salamu alayka ya Amin Allah fi ard.
Peace be upon you, O trusted guardian, appointed by Allah.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام أول عوض الحليم من حلمه أن الناس أنصاره على الجاهل.
Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam said, "The first reward the exerciser of forbearance gets
is that people become his helpers against the ignorant.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother, and we are discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. So, dear friends, it is our honor to be discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam, this magnificent persona in the history of the Muslims, but he is also a magnificent persona in the history of humanity. And it is our duty as Muslims and as Shias that we should introduce Imam Ali alayhi salam to the world. And we should introduce His Eminence, the divinely appointed first Imam and the Commander of the Faithful, in the most beautiful of ways. We must try not to make Imam Ali alayhi salam into a very cult-like individual or figure only related to us, 12 Shias. We must show Imam Ali alayhi salam to the world. And surely if we show Imam Ali alayhi salam to the world will flock to the door of the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Sometimes, dear friends, we have a tendency to feel like we're never going to die. We have a tendency to feel like we will live forever. And the way that we amass our wealth, the way that we greed for materialistic things, the way that we act and the way that we become arrogant or proud, condescending, we have this odd and very strange air about us as if we are the center of the universe, and other such things which really signal that we believe we will never die. And this idea, dear friends, that we will never die, is something that is of a serious detriment to us. Because if we forget death, we forget the day of judgment. And if we forget the day of judgment, we forget that we will be held accountable for what we do. Imam Ali alayhi salam, his life was spent in the remembrance of death, to the point where he very eloquently says that every breath a human being takes is a step closer to their inevitable death. If we were to keep such things in our mind, then we would never go astray from the path of Allah. We would never commit sins or mistakes. We would never disobey the Almighty Allah. And matter of fact, if we remember death and we realize that every breath we are taking is taking us towards our inevitable death, then we would truly begin to make a change in our lives. We would ask forgiveness from the Almighty Allah. We would begin to worship the Almighty Allah, and we would see a very beautiful and positive religious and spiritual change in our lives. If only we realized that death is a very true part of life, a very thought-provoking lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, the program To My Brother. This moment, I invite you to listen to the Arabic text of Ziyara Aminullah along with the English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. أشهد أنك جاهدت في الله حق جهاده وعملت بكتابه واتبعت سنن نبيه.
I testify
that you made utmost efforts, as it should be, in the cause of Allah, acted upon His book, followed the way of life of His Prophet, blessings of Allah be on him and his children, to the last moment of your life, until Allah invited you to come unto Him and used His discretion to take you away and sealed your enemies' doom with the blame that the arguments had been made known to one and all through you. O Allah, let me be happy and satisfied with that which Thou considers good for me. Let me agree with that which Thou decides for me. Let me passionately remember Thee and invoke Thee. Let me be in love with Thy pure and sincere friends. Let me be well-liked and respected on the earth and in the heavens. Let me be unruffled and well-composed in the midst of misfortunes. Let me be gratefully thankful in prosperity. Let me be mindful of much and more bounties. Let me ardently desire for the heart-warming meeting with Thee, well-equipped with piety to gain my end on the day of requital. Let me follow into the footsteps of Thy representatives. Let me disassociate myself from the mannerism of Thy enemies. Let me pass my time in this world by praising and glorifying Thee.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
Iman, it is an internal issue. Islam is the matter of tongue. Somebody can say, La ilaha illallah, Muhammadun Rasulullah. You can say, well, you are a Muslim. But what certificate do we have for the Iman? Because Iman resides in the heart. And that is where Rasulullah says, if you really want to see whether this person's heart has Iman or not, Ya Ali, لا يحبك إلا مؤمن ولا يبغضك إلا منافق. It is the hub of Ali which becomes the criteria or the measure and standard to know the Iman of an individual. So don't ask this question, when did Ali become Muslim? Because Ali is the mayar, he is the measure and the standard for the Iman of the Muslim. Salawat upon the Akbar. And so this status of Ali, that he never bowed down to worship an idol, is such a great honor that we see that Sunni Muslims in general, they actually respect Ali because of that. They have a special way of describing Ali, and they do not describe any Sahaba or Khalifa with those words. When they mention the name of Ali, they say, Karram Allahu wajhuhu. They don't use the word radiyallahu anhu. And what does the word Karram Allahu wajhuhu? Karram Allahu wajhuhu means Allah has honored his face. Because this face of Ali is the face which never went down in worship of an idol. And for centuries, Sunnis have been honoring Ali. Remember, this is not used by the Shias. Sunnis for centuries, when they mention the name of Ali, they say, Karram Allahu wajhuhu. Karram Allahu wajhuhu is affirmation of the honor that Allah has given to Ali. It is not the dua when you say, Radiallahu anhu. And this tradition has been there until Wahhabism emerged on the scene of the Muslim world. And the Salafis. Using their petrodollars, they have been propagating this idea that this is a bid'ah. Don't do this. I was just looking at that website, especially the ones that muftis use for answering questions. And there are questions about it. That is Trump, karram Allah.